KUT and KUTX listeners, the stream you've connected to is going silent on April 20th. You're likely using an old bookmark, app, or link that's been around a long time. Please visit kut.org/streams. That's kut.org/streams for more information. If you're still hearing this message next time you listen, there's a form at the bottom of that page that you can fill in for help. Our websites, apps, and npr.org are updated, so you can tune in there. Thank you for listening and supporting our stations.
This is KUT
Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the first weekend of July 2017. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. The fight over the state's new immigration law finally heads to court.
To take the sensible step of ensuring that state and local officials are permitted but not required to inquire about immigration status.
The much-delayed MOPAC Improvement Project.
There are disagreements between the contractor and ourselves over the causes of the delays.
And what's up with those blue flaps along the Lamar Boulevard underpass?
I had a friend suggest that maybe that they were diverting airflow.
That's not bad.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, I would like to invite you to subscribe to this podcast. You can do that at weekend.kut.org. You can do that in iTunes. If there's another way you want to get this podcast, let me know. Email me, nathan@kut.org, or you can just let me know on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. This was a pivotal week for the fate of new legislation intended to crack down on unauthorized immigrants living in Texas. The ban on so-called sanctuary cities, Senate Bill 4, SB 4 for short. This policy went before two federal judges in two separate lawsuits. One was filed by Texas cities and counties, largely run by Democrats, trying to stop the law from taking effect as scheduled in September. The other was a suit filed by the Republican Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton. That was a preemptive suit filed in anticipation of local governments violating the law. Austin Mayor Steve Adler is among the public officials named in that filing, and he was publicly questioning Paxton's logic.
Is this suit filed against the city and the county inappropriate because it is anticipating a violation of the law, which, one, can't be established. You can't sue someone in anticipation they're going to break the law. And quite opposite of that, all the indications are that the sheriff and the police chief have said they're going to follow the law.
So that case was heard in Austin by U.S. District Judge Sam Sparks. He did not issue a ruling yet. The other lawsuit was filed by several Texas cities and counties against the state. They're trying to stop SB 4 from taking effect. They're seeking a temporary injunction. Local officials are mainly concerned about the provision that allows police officers to ask about someone's immigration status during a routine stop. The law also requires local officials to honor all warrantless requests from federal immigration authorities to detain suspected undocumented immigrants for up to 48 hours after their release date. So that lawsuit by the cities and counties went before U.S. District Judge Orlando Garcia in San Antonio. Several hundred opponents of SB 4, including San Antonio's mayor, rallied on the steps of the courthouse outside.
Look, we know why we're here. And that is because anti-immigrant legislation that would make intolerance the law of the land is bad for business, it divides our communities, and make no mistake about it, let's listen to our law enforcement officials, it makes our communities more dangerous. When you have entire swaths of our community that are afraid to work with our police departments, afraid to work with our local law enforcement, that does not advance public safety. That makes it more likely to have an intolerant community where people are afraid to talk to the police, and we have a broken down community relations.
San Antonio Mayor Ron Nirenberg. State Attorney Mark Rylander says SB 4 only seeks to create uniformity in how local law enforcement honor federal immigration detainer requests.
The state of Texas asked the court to take the sensible step of ensuring that state and local officials are permitted but not required to inquire about immigration status in appropriate circumstances, and that they are required to honor federal ICE detainer requests. This is lawful, and the state feels confident that our arguments will ultimately prevail.
Judge Garcia told the attorneys he will likely make his decision on whether to put the law on hold later this summer. There's an invasive species spreading across Texas, and it's made it to the Austin area. As KUT's Trey Shaw reports, that's in spite of the best efforts of Texas wildlife officials.
Zebra mussels have been found in Lake Travis, and they've already taken a firm hold. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Department says they've found several size classes of adult and juvenile zebra mussels, which means Lake Travis is infested with an established reproducing population. In recent years, Texas law has required the cleaning of and draining of all water from boats in an effort to prevent transferring the mussels from one body of water to another. It's because zebra mussels can completely cover anything left underwater, including boat motors and public water intake pipes, and their sharp shells can cut bare feet. Monica McGarity is the Austin-based aquatic invasive species team leader for the Wildlife Department.
Clearly, the mussels got in somehow, and it just really underscores how important it is for everyone to clean, drain, and dry their boat, not to have the attitude that the spread of zebra mussels is inevitable.
Zebra mussels were first discovered in Eurasia in the 1700s. By the 1980s, they were in the Great Lakes along the Canadian border, and by 2009, they were in Lake Texoma along the Oklahoma border, continuing to spread south, now in the Highland Lake system just north of Austin. Trey Shar, KUT News.
The Austin Police Department is asking the Texas Forensic Science Commission to review how it stores refrigerated evidence. That's after this bombshell announcement this week that mold has been found growing on hundreds of unprocessed sexual assault evidence kits dating back to the 1990s and early 2000s. Interim Austin Police Chief Brian Manley says this mold was discovered in April and the department has taken some steps to ensure the integrity of the evidence.
We had some issues with some of the seals in the refrigerator. We redid all of the seals on the exterior of this particular refrigerator. We also had done a humidity test, and we discovered that the humidity was too high. So we ordered, and I think it's an industrial-type dehumidifier to install inside that refrigerator.
Manley says the mold was growing on the outside of about half of the 1,600 sexual assault evidence kits in the refrigerator. So far, no indication that this mold will affect the validity of the results from the tests of the DNA samples. However, people are concerned that the samples could now be vulnerable to challenges by defense attorneys. 4th of July is coming up. There's going to be a lot of fireworks going off. And this week, the Travis County Commissioner's Court opted not to enact a burn ban. But the Travis County Fire Marshal, Tony Calloway, says it was close.
Would have led to a burn ban this week if it had not been for the fortunate rain we received over the weekend, and fortunately some more that hit some of the areas, thankfully, that were not hit in the previous rainstorms. Since we're not under a burn ban, we have not prohibited the sale or use of sticks and fins, which would include skyrockets, bottle rockets. However, we do caution you that it is your responsibility if you choose to use those types of aerial devices that you are responsible for the outcome.
Fireworks sales started June 24th. They continue through July 4th at midnight. And this year, there's a change in how fireworks are sold. For the first time, consumers are allowed to handle the fireworks while shopping at indoor stores. As we record this podcast on a Friday, the majority leader in the United States Senate, Mitch McConnell, is exploring various options for salvaging the Republican health care bill. But he is facing a growing chorus of Republican detractors. And there's deepening uncertainty over whether the party can resuscitate its bedrock promise during the election campaign to repeal President Obama's health care overhaul. This week, McConnell unexpectedly abandoned plans to attempt to whisk the measure through his chamber because he lacked the votes to do it. So right now in Texas, almost a million people get their health insurance from the individual marketplace that was created by the Affordable Care Act. That's where insurers sell plans directly to individuals. The vast majority of Texans in that marketplace get some help from the federal government. They get subsidies to pay for their plans. The current Republican bill that would repeal Obamacare would change how much help certain people will get in the future. And as KUT's Ashley Lopez reports, that could mean fewer people will be able to afford plans in the marketplace in Texas.
Elizabeth Colvin is the director of Insure Central Texas. Since the start of the federal marketplace, her group has helped more than 22,000 people in this area sign up for health insurance.
Most of the people had not been able to get health insurance prior to the Affordable Care Act. So they were self-employed. We've also helped people who were excluded from insurance because of pre-existing conditions or the lifetime caps, and they were not eligible for health insurance.
So not only were people eligible for coverage, Obamacare subsidies attempted to offset the cost so people could afford to buy insurance. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, almost 90% of Texans on the Obamacare market get help paying for things like premiums and deductibles. Colvin says it makes a big difference. For example, she says, take someone making $15,000 a year.
They could get a plan with a very affordable premium, but then they could have a zero deductible. And an $850 out-of-pocket maximum, which is phenomenal. That's phenomenal coverage. And that's affordable enough for someone to be able to afford it on a monthly basis and to be able to use it.
And that is what could go away under the new Senate bill aimed at repealing Obamacare. As Stacey Pogue with the left-leaning Center for Public Policy Priorities explains, poor and older people in the market are going to find it very hard to afford insurance under the Senate plan.
What the Affordable Care Act did was make it easier for people who are older or sicker to get health care, right? The people who you would expect would need health care the most got some help accessing it. And the Senate bill undoes that structure where the people who you would expect would need health care the most, people as they age, people who are the lowest income, the people who are the most vulnerable, it places health care even further out of their reach.
For example, that person making $15,000 could see a deductible of up to $6,000. And Pogue says what will most likely happen is that person will drop out of the insurance market altogether.
They're not going to buy that coverage because there's no value in paying $200 or $500 a year for coverage when the deductible is half your income.
And Pogue says those costs will just shift to other people.
You don't stop needing health care. You still show up at a hospital emergency room. And the way those costs get absorbed is by providers passing on those costs, raising costs for people with private insurance, or local property taxes. Taxpayers at the local level are picking up those costs.
And that's not to mention that according to experts, not only will people be getting less help to pay for plans under the Senate bill, but their plans will also be covering less of their actual health care. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
United States Energy Secretary Rick Perry held a press conference this week. The White House dubbed this Energy Week, so they sent out Perry in the White House briefing room to speak to reporters, and he was pretty calm and collected up there on the podium. Reporters were asking him tough questions. He was giving it back to them, teasing them a little bit. It was actually a well-reviewed news conference, at least in terms of the style of it. But during this press conference, he doubled down on his contention that the role of humans in climate change should be up for debate. The former Texas governor said last week on CNBC that humans are not the main driver of global warming. And then this week during the news conference, he said this.
Climate's changing, always has. Man, at this particular point in time, is having effect on it. How much effect is what's at debate here?
That is not a debate for most climate scientists. We reached out to Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. She runs the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University. We wanted to get her response to Perry's comments. She said this, quote, "The reality is that humans are responsible for all of the observed warming and then some, because according to natural factors, we should be cooling right now, not warming," end quote. Now, as these greenhouse gases created by humans heat the atmosphere, we can expect more severe floods and more severe droughts. And that could be trouble for critical infrastructure such as bridges and roads in many cities. KUT's Mose Bushell takes a look at the risk posed right here in Central Texas.
In southeast Austin, where a creek runs under Hokie Lane, floods happen even in moderate rainfall. Pam Kerfoot is an engineer with the city's Watershed Protection Department.
This is the only way in and out of this whole neighborhood right here. And so we would have the water, you know, the road going underwater a lot. We have school buses going by. Our crews would have to come out and shut the road down a lot.
That's why a few years ago, the city upgraded the bridge.
Yeah, if you walk over this thing, you get the feeling the bridge is much longer than it needs to be. But
look closely beneath the bridge and you see evidence that all this area has been flooded out relatively recently. So if a heavy rain comes, this bridge here is going to be really necessary. Kerfoot says the city's looking at raising bridges or adding culverts in 5 to 10 other spots around town. She says sometimes that's because design standards have improved.
And sometimes it's just, you know, our understanding of risk changes, our ability to model rainfall and what rainfall does in creek systems, it changes.
And that's where climate change comes into play.
The problem is actually quite common all over the country.
Jim Schwab just retired as manager of the Hazards Planning Center for the American Planning Association. He says most bridges were built before we had a good knowledge of how global warming leads to more severe weather.
But if we can assume bigger floods, bigger rainstorms, the net result is that the bridge may need to be higher than it is now.
A couple years ago here in Austin, the group in charge of regional planning, known as CAMPO, commissioned a study on how climate change could affect 9 local bridges, roads, and rail lines. It found them all potentially vulnerable to increased flooding, drought, or extreme heat. Back on that bridge on Hokie Lane, Pam Kerfoot says this road needed work regardless of climate models. And other things added to the increase in flood risk as well, things like the increase in impervious cover that comes with development.
To us, you know, the data is the data. And if we have information that shows that, you know, our 100-year storm event should be bigger than what we're currently modeling, then we'll work to incorporate that.
The trick, she says, is to not just build infrastructure that will work for today's Austin, but that will serve in our city and our climate 50 years from now. Moz Bushell, KT News.
A minimum wage worker in the Austin Round Rock area would have to work 82 hours a week to be able to afford a modest one-bedroom apartment at fair market rent. That's according to a new report out this week by the National Low Income Housing Coalition. They crunched data from a number of sources. So they say the average rent for a one-bedroom in the Austin Round Rock area is $968, average rent. And they assume that people will spend a third of their after-tax income on rent. By the way, the statewide average is $770 for a one-bedroom. But in Austin, Round Rock, $968. So the average Austin rent is about 25% higher than Texas as a whole. Now, I was wondering how minimum wage workers can afford rent, because if you're making $7.25 an hour, a third of your income is $377. That is how much you would have for rent.
You just can't find that on the market.
That's Mandy DeMayo. She's the executive director of the affordable housing group Housing Works Austin. I called her up to ask what minimum wage earners in Austin are doing to make rent.
If you are a minimum wage worker and you have one job and you're looking for housing that you can afford on the market, it doesn't exist anymore. So your question was, what do they do? I see multiple strategies. One is working multiple jobs, which we see often. You know, you're not just doing a 40-hour work week with one minimum wage job. You've got multiple minimum wage jobs. The other is we see people doubling, tripling up, families doubling and tripling up. So we have overcrowding in a lot of situations. We also see people who are homeless with living out of their cars, so they don't have a fixed address. They may still be working, and oftentimes they are working, but they're living out of their cars or, as I mentioned before, doubling up. The other thing we see more and more, which contributes obviously to our traffic congestion, is people living farther and farther out. The farther away from the city core you go, the more affordable it presumably is, because if you're only taking housing costs into consideration, if you go into the outer lying areas of the MSA, you'll be able to find some presumably affordable options. Household affordability is more than just housing expenses. It's housing, it is utilities, it's transportation. And the farther out you go, the more you have to rely on your own vehicle. The more you stress our transportation infrastructure, the less reliable you are as an employee, because your commute is farther. You may not have a reliable car. There are environmental impacts. It's just not the way we want to grow as a city, which is one of the reasons we just believe strongly about embedding affordability within the city of Austin.
A lot of people who don't make a minimum wage think it's not important because it doesn't affect them, but minimum wage workers in many ways help the city move because
Absolutely.
They're working many of the service jobs.
Absolutely. And it's not just minimum wage. I want to expand that a bit to talk about low-wage workers. We have a lot of folks, when you look at kind of growing fields in the economy, retail, one, that's a lot of low-wage workers, and two, healthcare services like home health aides. Those are low-wage workers, but crucial to making our economy work and keeping us healthy as a community. Childcare workers, I mean, I could go on and on, but these are all of the folks who really make our community tick. And if we lose one segment, the rest doesn't function.
Mandy DeMayo, Executive Director of Housing Works Austin. The MOPAC Improvement Project was supposed to be done 2 years ago in 2015. And if you ride on MOPAC, you may have noticed that halfway through 2017, it's still not done. This is a project that puts tolled lanes in each direction on MOPAC from Palmer Lane to Cesar Chavez. And toll prices will go up or down to ensure the lane is always moving at a minimum speed of 45 miles an hour, even during rush hour. So if it's going slower than that, the toll goes up. And the idea is that fewer people will be willing to pay that toll, so the fewer people will be in the lane. That will make the lane go faster. And then, if need be, the toll can go down, and they try and keep it above 45 miles an hour. So KUT's Nadia Hamden had a look at why it's taking so long to get this done.
I met Bobak Torani in the parking garage of the Chase building downtown. He works with the engineering consulting company Stantec. It's been a long day, and he's ready to make the commute home.
I mean, it's, you know, it's funny because you hear people calling it Slowpack all the time.
In a perfect world, Highway Loop 1, or MOPAC, would be a straight shot between Tehrani's home and office. But that's not the reality.
I avoid MOPAC regardless of whether it was under construction or not. I've been living here for 9 years, so I've always found other routes to take as opposed to our major highways during the peak hour, if I can.
Tehrani's not alone. Countless other Austin residents do the same. MOPAC gets congested, really congested, and they feel construction efforts to relieve that congestion have only made it worse. One of the biggest beefs? The project that will add a managed toll lane heading both ways on MOPAC north of the river is more than 2 years overdue. Colorado-based CH2M Hill won the bid with a contract of $136 million, and the project started. It was scheduled to be complete by September 2015. Everything seemed to be going great until it wasn't.
There are disagreements between the contractor and ourselves over the causes of the delays and whether or not they are reasonable causes.
That's Steve Pustelnik. He's the director of community relations at the Central Texas Regional Mobility Authority, the group that hired CH2M to build the project. He says CH2M attributed delays to a variety of reasons, ranging from a struggle to find workers to issues breaking through hard rock. Some argue the company's low-cost design just wasn't thought out properly. CH2M and their subcontractor Lane Construction denied KUT's request for comment on the project and its delays. Pustelnik says the wait has cost CH2M millions of dollars in fines.
There have been liquidated damages withheld to the tune of about $20 million for the delays that have been experienced.
Back on the road, Bobak Torani says he doesn't think a toll lane will solve the congestion problem, but the MOPAC project is still worthwhile. The way he sees it, congestion is never going away, and neither are the attempts to improve it.
We have absolutely no choice. It has to happen. We're not going to build a wall around this city and stop people from coming in. I mean, the fact that people think that that's going to stop blows my mind away.
The Mobility Authority says they're optimistic MOPAC will be finished by September, but nothing's concrete. Nadia Hamden, KUT News.
When you're out enjoying some live music in Austin, you're probably not thinking about the development rules governing the venue you're inside. If you're having a good time, I guarantee you, you're not thinking about the development rules. But Austin's new land development code, known as Code Next, will have big implications for that kind of thing. All of the city's creative spaces. KUT's Saida Hassan has a report about that.
Dozens of Austin artists, performers, and venue owners gathered at the Canopy Cultural Center on Springdale Road. Shirley Rempe with the city's Cultural Arts Division walked visitors through the basics of what Code Next means for entertainment and artistic venues.
The Land Development Code is the city code and regulation that tells you what you can build, where you can build it, and to some extent, what size and shape that building can take, and how it should be situated on the site as well.
Rempe's department is in the process of reviewing the proposed code, trying to ensure that people throughout Austin will have access to nearby cultural amenities. Since Code Next is making changes to current zoning, Rempe broke down what types of cultural facilities would be allowed in each of the new zoning categories. For example, an outdoor entertainment venue can be permitted in an industrial or commercial zone, but not in a residential or transect zone. That's a new zoning category that would apply to certain areas, mainly Central Austin. Rempe says city staff are trying to take a nuanced approach to how the code distinguishes between different types of spaces.
Although, you know, they might all be an art gallery at the bottom, they take different shapes and sizes. So having those more nuanced definitions makes sure that we can fit the right venue, fit the right cultural creative space in the right place, in the right zone.
Her department displayed maps showing what types of cultural spaces could be built around the city under Code Next. Dancer Alexa Caporeta came out to learn about the new regulations.
Just curious as to the sort of code laws that govern the city, especially with some fair amount of theater closures or rehearsal space closures in the past couple of years that have affected, I think, the art-making community.
Caporeta is in the process of producing a new dance performance, and she says affordable venues are getting harder to find.
People have responded in creative ways, I think, to it, having performances at more unconventional venues.
Caporeta is far from the only artist with affordability concerns. That issue was a major consideration in Mayor Steve Adler's 2016 Music Omnibus Resolution. Saida Hassan, KUT News.
Outdoor live music is going later in Austin's Red River Cultural District. A pilot program launched in May allowed venue operators with outdoor stages to stay open an extra hour on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights. Those are lucrative hours for liquor sales. And the goal was to give the music venues a financial lift as they're facing some of the same affordability problems plaguing the rest of Austin. So we're now a couple months into it or so. Is it working? Chad Switecki is with our reporting partner, the Austin Monitor, and he has some of the preliminary numbers. Hi, Chad.
Hello, Nathan.
How are these venues doing now that they can keep their outdoor stages open an hour later on Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights?
We've gotten an early look at the first month of business. This pilot program took effect in May, and the state's liquor tax reports for those venues just was made available. And what you're seeing is of the five venues that have outdoor stages that could benefit from these later hours, you're seeing proven three of the venues have noticeable increases. Two of them also are going to be updating their numbers, and they tell me that they're seeing benefits as well. As much, you know, at the Mohawk, you saw a 65% uptick. Empire Control Room, their co-owner, tells me they've seen a 15% boost in business, and you've seen some smaller but still noticeable increases at Barracuda and Cheer Up Charlie's. And those are all venues that promote Austin and local young bands very heavily. So that's seen as a bonus for something like this.
Right. Steven Sternshine, co-owner of Empire Control Room, told you something interesting about how much more people spend on alcohol in that last hour that they're allowed to continue operating their outdoor stage.
Yes. So Steven said that when you think about the bar business, you typically have a big chunk of your business coming in on the weekends, and that's even further concentrated on the late night hours after 11 o'clock when the per person spend almost doubles. And he said that after 11 o'clock, you're getting roughly 70% of your business for an evening because everyone goes out, and as the hours get later, well, you know how that goes.
Another big question about this pilot program was, will having the music go an hour later on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights on those outdoor stages, will that generate more noise complaints? What are the indications surrounding that issue?
That is kind of the next big question on this. And in some preliminary talks that I've had with city staff who are monitoring this stuff like a hawk, because they want to see how it goes.
Right.
early data was that things were going well, and that when you tracked any noise complaints from affected neighborhoods that typically would think, you know, that would experience some of these, that the noise complaints weren't even lining up with set times or when there was loud music or live music happening. And so you would have to attribute any noise disturbances to some other source. Typically, what people think has been happening is the noise disturbances have been getting pinned on those outdoor music venues when maybe it's coming from somewhere else. And now we've kind of got coordinated efforts to track this stuff. All of this stuff is going to be compiled on a regular basis. Noise complaints, sales, number of live acts booked, any kind of data that can make a case for or against this pilot program is going to be compiled and analyzed pretty rigorously and regularly. It's just a 6-month trial program with the possibility of being extended somewhat indefinitely in the fall. So it's kind of a grand experiment of sorts with Austin Live Music.
All right, and we know you'll be tracking it as well. Chad Switecki with our reporting partner, the Austin Monitor, telling us about early numbers for a new pilot program in the Red River Cultural District that allows venues with outdoor stages to continue operating those stages an extra hour on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights. You can read Chad's story at austinmonitor.com. Thanks for your time, Chad.
Thanks, Nathan.
Imagine you're driving down Lamar Boulevard between 5th and Cesar Chavez. You know the area I'm talking about? I mean, maybe you're there right now and you're listening to this. But look around. What do you see? Maybe something blue that looks a little odd or out of place? For the next episode of our AT Explained project, KUT's Matt Largy investigated a question you might have asked yourself.
So we ventured over here to this little drainage ditch.
It's kind of steep.
Can I take your shoulder?
Oh, yeah, of course.
I'm here with Laura Bauman.
It's a little rough to get over here.
Bad.
We're peering over the edge of the train bridge that goes over Lamar just north of Lady Bird Lake.
All right, so we can see one of these signs here.
Oh, yeah, there's two more.
Laura asked a question about these blue signs for our AT Explained project. She wants to know, what on earth are they?
Looks like somebody just cut up some old highway signs and it's a practical joke. I don't know.
There's 8 or 9 of them on each wall of the underpass sticking out over the sidewalk. They're blue, like highway rest stop blue, and they're at odd angles.
It looks like it's the beginning of something.
If you've ever driven here, you've seen them.
I had a friend suggest that maybe that they were diverting airflow.
That's not bad.
Right. That, at least that would give it a purpose.
Yeah.
Well, Laura, prepare yourself. I'm going to answer your question right away. It's art.
Well, that's disappointing.
Don't be disappointed yet. You may be surprised by what it, you know, maybe it means something really deep and you're, you know, it really makes you think. Who knows?
I'll be honest, it hadn't made me think about something deep. I've never heard anyone say anything nice about the blue signs. No one gets it. There's no plaque, no information about the artist, nothing about what the blue signs mean. So that's what I wanted to find out. I went into the story thinking this installation is just bad art, but now it's complicated.
Yeah, people are confused about whether or not it's art.
This is Sue Lamb.
We've collected some responses over the years, and I've got a little list here.
She runs the city's Art in Public Places program.
Some people were thinking they're intended to be like bird-shaped signs.
Or some kind of alien signal.
Or sound baffling.
Or,
you know, they could be for truck safety.
Yeah, I can see that one. But no, 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 and no. The real story goes back to the year 2000.
Council actually looked at what can we do in this area to enliven it, to make it look more interesting and more beckoning to that area that is just north of the Lamar Underpass.
The city council set aside $45,000 for the project. 28 artists submitted proposals for installations in the underpass. And in 2002, they chose a design from a local architect named Carl Treminski. It was called Moments.
It's not called Blue Signs.
The project site is visualized as a threshold between the urban Austin and the natural Austin.
This is a reading from Treminski's original proposal for Moments.
The underpass marks a journey through the city's self-image, between the urban center of business and entertainment.
6th Street in downtown.
To the city's heart of natural beauty and enjoyment.
Town Lake at the time.
This proposal intends to strengthen the expression and experience of this moment.
He was actually thinking about those blue signs in ways of responding to the lake. He noted that the people running along the lake are doing so rhythmically, and those signs were intended to sort of mimic that rhythm. And he also noted that people were rowing on the lake, and the dip of the oars as they went down the lake was also a rhythmic kind of experience, and he wanted to respond to that with the rhythm of these signs.
Dip. 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 Dip.
If you look from far away, you can see how the angle of the signs on each side change as you move through. Tilted to vertical to tilted the other way, almost like a paddle moving through the water. The walls of the underpass were painted in green and brown, and there was a time when the spot was bathed in blue light at night, powered by solar panels near the train tracks. But within a few years, the panels were damaged and the lights were taken down. Now, all that remain are the signs.
You know, at this point, it almost feels like a relic. Like, so much of it has, you know, the lighting's gone. A couple of the signs are gone.
The painted walls are basically gone, you know, or faded.
There's a guy named Phil Reed. He's a local architect. He actually designed those huge metal LED lights under the I-35 underpass near 6th Street, the ones that look like a rib cage. I met with him at the Lamar underpass because I thought he might have a take on moments. We stare into the underpass pit, surveying the blank blue signs.
The idea is, I believe, that you're looking for information there and you're not finding it, which some people find extraordinarily frustrating.
And he says he gets that. It is frustrating. Maybe that's the point. And maybe that's why everyone hates it.
But at the same time, we wouldn't be here talking about it, looking down into this pit, unless this art was successful. If it was a complete failure, no one would have any interest in it. Even people's frustration with it is a sign of its success. It's given itself to us in that way.
You know, it's okay if a third of the people love the work, a third of the people don't have a reaction, a third of people hate it. I think that can be the mark of success.
That's Sue Lamb again.
I think that's one of the reasons we love art, is that it gets us thinking and gets us interpreting.
Phil's interpretation? He's a fan.
So here you are driving through a space that probably, I'm not a neuroscientist, but I think typically people's brains sort of shut off. There's so much information coming in from your physical environment that you've got to kind of filter it out. And when you go to places like this, you're going to think about something else while you're driving through it. And it's kind of a neat idea that you would bring this place to your consciousness through this little trick, if you will.
Dip, 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 dip.
At this point, you're probably wondering about Carl Treminski, the guy behind the blue signs. Well, so am I. I tried to reach him, but he didn't seem to want to talk. I wanted to ask him about his vision for moments, about what he makes of the criticism, about what it all means. So Carl, if you're listening, call me, man. But maybe he just wants to let moments speak for itself. A plaque would help, though, I'm just saying. Matt Largy, KUT News. That is KUT Weekend for the first weekend of July 2017. Thank you so much for listening. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. Send us your questions. Send us your comments to nathan@kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶